Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is Tuesday, July 22nd, 2003. Today's session is entitled Pitbull Politics, Session 2 of Politics and Public Policy, presented by John Marty. Let's listen in.
Nature of things now. Lincoln Douglas debates 150 years ago, rural Illinois, where they were, and we all know about them this many years later, they had people, 10,000 people come for an outdoor debate without microphones in the last 3 hours. Politicians had to have very strong vocal cords, apparently. And it was entertainment. I mean, 10,000 people coming to a small rural county, that was people making the 40-mile trip by horse or whatever to get to listen to candidates do it. They took their politics very seriously. And anybody who is going to make an all-day outing to go see a spectacle of this sort is going to take it seriously and is probably on the way back debating themselves if they disagree or fleshing it out. And now the vast majority of Americans get most of their information about politics and political candidates by broadcast media, primarily television. And when you look, Minnesota, to turn to the example I know, Minnesota had two hotly contested congressional races, which is fairly rare, since like 90-some percent of 95-96% of congressional races for next year, they'll be able to tell you by January or February who's likely to win 95% of them, and they'll be right 99% of the time. The other 4 or 5% are contested. Minnesota had two of our 8 races were hotly contested because of new districts, and they were both multi-million dollar races. And if you watch those ads, I don't think most Minnesotans would have been surprised if either the candidates in either one of the races were arrested for child molesting. I mean, they were accused of virtually everything else in the ads. I mean, just brutal stuff, on and on, and how crooks they are, and how dishonest they are, and how this they are, and how that they are. And I told my wife several years ago, if people believe half the things they heard about me in attacks, I wouldn't vote for me either if I believed that. And so as I want to spell out how I see the issue and what I think is a possible solution, I hope you'll think back, and I remember a lot of the ads because I pay attention to this in a way that others, you may pay attention during the course of it. You may, just because of sheer repetition, get be drummed into you, but I don't know how much you can remember of any particular ads. But if you think of some... You turn the volume off. That helps. But if you can remember any ads you saw last year or 2 years earlier or so, and think about it, when I propose what I was saying is a potential solution, I want you to try and do some thinking of how it would fit into the ads you've seen and whether it would have an impact. And why do we have these ads? Does anybody here like these negative ads?
I don't
think most people do. I think it's 99% of the public would tell you they don't like it. Why do we do it? Well, political media consultants have tracking polls. Every day they run new polls, a new ad comes out, and they're not precise polls, but they say, ooh, there's movement in public opinion this way. And the polls suggest, and the media consultants who are high paid, that's one occupation I wish we could eliminate from the face of the earth, political media consultants. I think we'd be better off. But they're not bad people, but it's an occupation I don't think we really, it doesn't help our democracy. But they take polls and they find out that ads work. Of course, if I go out there and start calling my opponent a thief and a robber and a whatever I want to accuse my opponent of, it's not going to help. People are going to say, boy, he's nasty. And if you think of the ads you've seen last year, how many of them have it where candidate A is slamming his opponent? None of them. I mean, that's one of the things about a debate. If you have a Lincoln Douglas style debate, if Abe Lincoln says bad things about Stephen Douglas, you know, if he oversteps his bounds or if he does cheap shots, people are, ooh, he's slimy. You may want to say some things about your opponent that aren't popular, but at least there's the check and balance that you said them and it's going to rub off on you. You throw mud and some of it's going to come back, ricochet back and hit you. So you don't see the candidate doing those ads. And the political consultants are very smooth, very high-paid people who come in and do the dirty work, and their ethic is whatever works is good. Whatever wins elections, there's no downside to do whatever works to win. And they do it sophisticated. They're very seldom will you ever see a candidate saying negative things about their opponent on an ad. In the news media, they may issue criticism. Now campaigns issue press releases, new things to look up about the opponents. But in a speech or whatever, a candidate, I've said things about my opponents that I'm proud of having said and that were accurate, and I'm willing to say face voters and say, this is what I disagree with my opponent on, and here's why. I think that's wrong. I don't mind saying those things about my opponent. But if I'm willing to say it and take the heat because if I overstep my bounds, they ought to nail me. Well, that's different. But the consultants know that you shouldn't do that in an ad because you can't say what you want to really say to dig the dirt, to raise the doubts, to raise the questions about your opponent and about your opponent's message. And so they have two types of things that they find out work, one of which is the brutal slam from the unknown source, a voice on TV. And it's not just what the words are said, it's the visuals, the fear, the music. I mean, you watch an Alfred Hitchcock movie, what makes it work? It's the sound in the background. It gets you real tense and excited. Well, you do that about your opponent when you're saying he or she's doing fearful things that are going to hurt people. Well, you do the brutal slam from the unknown person. Or you do the kill them with kindness kind of thing. My opponent's a really nice person, very well-intentioned, but, you know, they're so naive or so. I've had that kind of attack many times. We really like them, but, and those tend to be not happening as often in ads in recent years, but the trick is, media consultants do, is we want to be as negative and as hard-hitting as we can without looking like we're being negative and hard-hitting. We don't want them to see it as negative. We want to do this. Well, thinking back to the races in your state, your community, you don't have to answer this, but I think I know the answer. Did these multi-million dollar ad campaigns provide any useful information?
Yeah.
Did the repetition enlighten you when you see the same ad 10 times and 20 times? Because I'm often looking for this, because I want to see what kind of dirt, what's being said, what's happening. Same reason I watch the TV news for political things is not because I want to get political news from it, but because that's where most of the public gets its news. So I better find out what my constituents are seeing and what's shaping their opinions. But so I turn to these. Oh, there's an ad. I'll actually tune in to try and find the messages. I don't know. But so I don't watch that much TV, so I have to make an intentional thing to find out what's being said about it. But I see, some ads weren't negative attacks. I see the same ad over and over. And I call one candidate who I was supporting and who was running too much of the same ad. I said, why in the world do you keep running this so much? And, oh, we're about done with that one now. I said, well, you should have been done about 3 months ago. But just the repetition enlightening. And is there anyone who's not disgusted by it all? Well, my thought about the whole process is it is deteriorating and it is getting worse. It's a type of attack, more sophistication, all computer modeling and polling and focus group. Before you run any ads in the statewide and the bigger races, they measure everything to figure out what the likely reaction is. And it's sometimes very subtle. They're not trying to say, don't vote for this person. They're trying to suggest maybe this person's whole theme about how they're working for you is really devious and that they're a devious person somehow, and start raising a few doubts here and there, and then later on they do this. And campaign strategies often, first you're gonna destroy your opponent, then you're gonna do positive, warm, fuzzy stuff about yourself. It's all carefully measured in how to do that. And I've been the victim of some attacks. I think most candidates who've run have had people attacking them, many of which I think are unfair. Our local legislative races in Minnesota do not have media. My opponent a couple of years ago ran some cable TV ads, which are very cheap because nobody watches them. Because they're not on the major Showtime and HBO and popular ones that are on the local access cable that is small audience. I mean, not nobody watches, but small number. And he actually had some, he ran against me twice, and the first time he had these funny ads. He was, his last name was Zazadny, and he had a Z logo, a Superman logo, an inverted triangle. He did one, apparently, I didn't get to see this because I don't have cable, but he rips off his thing and he goes and helps a lady across. It was funny ads, so great and clever and creative and more powerful. This last time he, I don't know if he did ads like that, but he ran, he was doing mailings. I mean, we got about six of them in our house in the last 2 weeks, and who all received which ones, I couldn't feel what kind of targeting system he had while we got that many. But we found about 10 different mailings the last 2 weeks. Nothing had hit until 2 weeks before. Nothing. And so we're working, and our volunteers are saying, well, why are you working so? I haven't seen anything to your opponent. The last 2 weeks, he was hammered. You do it late, you do it at attacks. The last day, Monday before the November election, I come home, and there's a flyer we got lots of calls from people saying, yeah, what's this thing about this attack? A comparison piece. John Marty accepted over $19,000 in special interest money. Despite what he says, or despite his claims not to accept any, John Marty accepted over $19,000 or $17,000 or something in special interest money. And that suggested either I'm lying about something and maybe doing something illegal and whatever else. But this arrives in our mail, which comes around 3 o'clock on the day before the election. We have in legislative races, no real, as I said, media, other than newspapers, which are weeklies, or mailings. And you can't really get something out between 3 o'clock on Monday afternoon and the time people go to the polls at 7 in the morning. And so you're stuck. Well, what was the issue with that? How could he say those things about me? Well, I've had a policy since 1990 that I won't accept any what I call special interest money. I'm going to talk about that tomorrow, about the issue of big money in politics. I don't take anything over $100 from anyone. I ran for governor 10 years ago and did it without the $2,000 contributions, without the $20,000 soft money, without the lobbyist money, without the PAC money. Nothing over $100, and I'm proud of that, and I think it's important to do, and I think we have to reform the system so everybody has to do that. But since 1990, I haven't taken a penny from anyone like that. We raised $1 million in the gubernatorial campaign out of $25 and $50 and $100 checks. And what's he saying then? Well, back in 1986 when I first ran, and until 1990, I was kind of troubled by the campaign finance system, but everybody does it this way. And I took every legal contribution, which I think I could take $1,000 contributions as a candidate for state senate at the time. And I took them from anybody who offered them, which wasn't a whole lot of them. But over the course of first year and afterwards, I must have received $17,000 or whatever my opponent claimed in the mailing. I'm sure he checked it out and had something accurate so I couldn't sue him. But I must have taken that. So his mailing arriving the day before implies, John Marty's lying to us about this because he makes this thing that he doesn't take special interest money. And here, he actually took this much and he can document it. Well, that was 13 years earlier. And I never claimed I never took it. I just said at that point I wrote a paper saying why I thought it was not good and I returned a lot of the money that I received in the year before. And decided I wasn't going to do it anymore. Whatever office I run for, I'm staying with this commitment. And but that's the nature of how they run these things. When I ran for a gubernatorial race, I won the party nomination, I won the primary, and I got creamed in November. I would argue, at least in part, because we refused to run some negative ads that we had some media consultants, like everybody in the statewide campaigns, we had media consultants. And they came in and they proposed these. And they knew I wouldn't run really hard, nasty, nasty, brutal things. So they had some that looked like they weren't so hard and so on, but they were either dumb, in my mind, just plain dumb, or they were stupid, mean-spirited attacks that were designed to look not that way. And at one point, I had a guy who was calling the shots on that, and he said, if you're not going to run this ad, I'm going to have a news conference and release the ad. It was going to be about my opponent, who was the incumbent, having a cabin in Wisconsin. It was a dumb attack, but it was kind of nasty anyhow. And he was going to have a news conference right across the Minnesota border in Wisconsin. And I called him and said, no, we're not going to do that. He said, well, then I'm going to have a news conference and announce that I'm quitting. And he did that, and it definitely hurt my campaign because I refused to run some of those. They weren't brutal as they were mainly stupid, but and it's my fault. Our campaign had hired the guy, and I did not. He was very poor judgment in my mind, but he moved out of state, which is good as far as I'm concerned. But I've had that sort of experience the first time I ran. I believe we should have campaigns. I like the Lincoln-Douglas debate model. I like the idea where you put out a lot of substance. First time I ran for state legislature, I had like 20 full-page, single-spice, small-space, small-type position papers. People joked that the only person who read all my position papers was my opponent, so he could attack me from it. And he did. That does not give you a lot of incentive as a candidate to put out substance. Though I remember I'd have summaries of position papers in the brochures I was carrying door to door, which is the primary way you run a legislative campaign in Minnesota. We have spending limits, we have relatively small districts, mine's 75,000 to 80,000 people. And so you can go and visit a lot of people at their doors. And I remember that summer, and Connie and I worked umpteen hours that year going door to door. I have a brochure, everyone had an issue paper in it. And I'd tell them at the door, here's a brochure and an issue paper, I hope you take a look at it. And I remember hot days walking down the streets and some guy would be sitting on his porch steps and then be coming back to the other side of the street 10, 15 minutes later. He'd still be there reading the stuff. Some people do. It may be a small percentage, but I think if you give people fluff, they expect fluff. You give them substance, maybe they expect the substance. So I think it's worth doing. But so I've had experience on this all the while and thinking that what we're doing is destroying democracy by this negative stuff. Why do people not show up at the polls? There are a number of reasons, but I don't think you would want to vote for people whose ads you see on TV and the people who are putting them out shouldn't want to vote for them either. So what do? You stay home, and the public does. So if we want to address this issue, what do we do about it? And again, I hope that as I'm going through what I'm proposing you do, that you try and envision the ads that you've seen in the past, whether you think they were fair or not fair, and whether this would address them or not. But first of all, why can't we just ban certain types of things? Well, our Constitution, I think rightly and legitimately, says, you know, free speech is the best way to get past this. Don't bar people from saying certain things, but have a vibrant debate so it can be rebutted and so people can debate it and discuss it. And that's good. And I think strongly support that. I think our problem is we're moving away from the chance for anyone to rebut it because people just hammer home the same nasty things over and over and over. But constitutionally, I don't know that you could very well find a way to say this ad is okay and this ad is not okay. And if you ban certain things, that means government saying you can't say this, you can't say that. And that's a very, very difficult, I'd argue, impossible task in an area like this. So you try voluntary codes. In 1996, there was a former newspaper reporter in Minnesota who proposed a Minnesota Clean Campaign Compact. And Maine, the same year, had a thing. In Maine, they were a little more successful. All of their candidates for U.S. House and Senate agreed to abide by it, and I read some of the reports about it. They said, well, there was, quote, some slippage in commitment to this. Minnesota, none of the statewide candidates abided by it. I was up for election in 96 and signed it, and tried to add a few things and tried to encourage the people sponsoring it to make some changes in it that I thought they could get some statewide candidates to participate. But it's voluntary, and that obviously causes some trouble. But there is a group now, Pew Foundation is funded through Institute for Global Ethics, a project on campaign conduct. And if you make a mental note, campaignconduct.org is their website, and they're trying to initiate groups in various communities around the country to do a clean campaign compact. And I watched what they're doing. I'd like to see what they're trying to do. But I don't know that theirs is going to be a lot more successful than the Minnesota effort 6-7 years ago or the one in Maine. And there are lots of communities. And they basically go asking candidates to sign a pledge saying, we won't do this and this and certain steps on that. In trying to do this, trying to set up a system in which there's some sort of enforcement. And I think you can do some sort of enforcement on a voluntary code, not through legal sanctions, but through political and social stigma. If the media and the public says, this violates the code, the candidate has every legal right to run whatever they want, and their supporters have every right to run whatever they want, but if the public, the news media is saying, this violates that code, then people might, that's not below board, and candidates might be pressured into abiding by it. So you need some sort of enforcement. And in Minnesota, we had a thing that I thought might be a good model. We have a news council. It's funded by some foundations. The news media takes it very seriously. They have no power to do anything other than when somebody files a complaint about unfair reporting. They will take up the issue, they study the issue, they make some findings on it. And news media is scared of them. I mean, we don't want a negative finding that we did something unfair. And they take it very seriously. They go in and explain their case, they defend it, and they take it very seriously. And I think that model might work here. Then you need some standards that are in partisan hardball politics. You need some standards. And they have to be fairly objective. Otherwise, my candidates, folks, those are serious issue points. Those are legitimate to make. We got to do that. The other side, they're doing the slimy, unfair stuff. Then you listen to debates, and the candidates who throw out the most slime are usually the ones who are most accusing their opponents of throwing mud. I mean, it's part of the sophisticated move. Your best defense is a good offense. You attack them with negative stuff, and you accuse them of negative stuff at you. But why don't we just have some simple standards? How about banning all personal attacks? Well, that's kind of hard to do, too. And let me give an example of one Minnesota prominent, now U.S. senator, several years ago was running for governor, and he was attacking his opponents as being soft on crime and drugs, because his opponent had 20 years earlier been in the legislature and voted in the early 70s, 30 years ago now, they voted to make marijuana possession a misdemeanor, not a felony, to reduce the penalties of it, which was actually the hard-on-crime position in the early 1970s. The soft-on-crime was to decriminalize it, make it just a fine, couldn't serve jail time or anything. But anyhow, this opponent had voted to reduce the penalties on it, so he was attacking him as being soft on crime. Well, this candidate had admitted, to his credit, he admitted it. He didn't have much choice because it was public knew about it, or at least a handful of opponents and others knew about it. When he was in college in the 60s, he was a radical, made a big deal about it, and he didn't support decriminalization of marijuana. He wanted legalization, and he smoked it and so on. And so he and his party were running attacks against his opponent, saying, this guy is soft on crime. He voted to reduce penalties for marijuana use. And I wrote a letter to him and the media and several others saying that this is really hypocritical. His marijuana use was a youthful indiscretion. Well, that's fine. I think young people do mistakes. Older people do mistakes. We all are human. We all make mistakes. And he admitted that this was a mistake, and he was younger then and made some foolish mistakes. But in effect, what he's saying is, what I did was youthful indiscretion, but some young person who does a youthful indiscretion now should be a felon. And I've not only changed my beliefs on it, but I think anybody else who does should be there. And I think that after he's attacking on the substance to his opponent did vote for weakening penalties on marijuana possession, that maybe it wouldn't be unfair if the opponent who didn't choose to do this would run ahead saying, listen, this guy who's attacking me for being soft on crime, he personally used this. What he thought should be legal at the time, he now wants young people to go to prison for. And so you can't really say all personal attacks might be unfair, and all issue attacks are fair, especially because there's a good ability of people to twist and distort. I learned that in my first campaign with all those issue papers where you could take little sentences out of them and use them in very creative ways. candidates are very creative. So banning personal attacks doesn't work necessarily. And so you need some objective standards that you could do. So what I tried to do is, based on the codes that I had seen proposed around it, I came up with a, a voluntary proposal. As I mentioned, I don't think you can constitutionally do it mandatory, but you would have some sanctions for it. And the political consequences of those sanctions would be the media and the public. This violates that code. This candidate is playing dirty pool, and that has an impact. Political consultants know that, and they will not go out of their way to do it. And it doesn't suggest there should be no criticism. My first race, I ran telling what I was going to do, all those position papers and so on, and my opponent said that he was an ego scout, he was a volunteer in the community, he was captain of the college football team 10 years earlier, he was a police sergeant. He had one piece that was nothing more than glamorous photos of his wife saying, oh, what a sweet guy her husband was. But you've never seen pink newspaper ads, but they had a baby girl born a month before the election, so there are pink ads all over the place. But it was very, no issues. Once the newspapers were doing endorsements and he was supposed to win, and the media, I would argue, this is my opinion of it, but I think the two Twin City papers tend to endorse people, for the most part, that they think are going to win. Not exclusively, but they do tend to do that. And they had screened me for, because I had a primary opponent, they had screened me for that and interviewed me for that, and said they'd call me back in the fall, and they didn't. And I, about mid-September, I thought, they're going to do their endorsement soon, so I better call them up. And, well, we already interviewed you. I said, well, yeah, but you're interviewing my opponent. Now you got 3-month-old notes on me, and you're going to take a fresh interview with him. That's not really fair. And then, well, you don't have much of a chance anyway. The difference is great. And which really burns when you're working full-time like doing this at the time and think how unfair this is. I said, well, can I at least send you my issue papers? Oh, I think we already have it. I said, it? And I said, which it do you have? I said, do you mind if I send them? Oh, go ahead, send them to us. So I sent him a whole packet of not only the 20 issue papers, but all the brochures, which also said a lot of things about direction and policy. And I said, I'm going to take the unusual step of also sending my opponent's literature, since you seem to be convinced he's going to win and should win, and you're, frankly, going to endorse him, but to show what he's done. And he says, as you can see, he's an ego scout, he's this and this and this, but you can't find a single word of what he stands for, other than he likes education and lower taxes and less crime and everything, that motherhood and apple pie, which we all support. But nothing, no substance on any issue. And paper may have thought it was snotty or something, but they endorsed him. But I'm not arguing that fluff is bad. I mean, we have pictures of the dog and our family dog in the picture. We want people to think we're a normal family. I think we are in some ways. I hope we are. Picture your family and your cute little kids when they're cute little kids, and the dog and everything else. There's nothing wrong with that. And I don't have a problem with my opponents criticizing me. I have a problem with the twisting and the distortion. So how to make the substance of what I was going to suggest is not that there be no criticism, not even hard-hitting criticism, but that you have a code, a very brief code, the first of which was that any criticism of a candidate, in order to comply with the code, in ads or other campaign materials would have to be said by the candidate or quoting the candidate saying about their opponent. Any surrogates inside the campaigns or outside organizations, others could criticize them in speeches. If you're a business leader, you could accuse somebody of being anti-business in a speech or in mailings to your own membership. Labor leader could attack somebody for being anti-labor and so on. They could attack, so in other words, they could do it, but any paid media, mail brochures are mailed to the general public or newspaper ads or TV radio ads, would have to be, in order to comply with the code, would have to be said by the candidate who's making the attack. Not that. Why? Because you've had accountability. And now here, think back at the ads you've seen in your own community. How many of the times would the person accusing somebody of being a crook or a criminal or a slimy character, how many times would their opponent have been willing to say that in an advertisement that they're paying for? Very seldom. But that's the central key to the proposal, because it's designed to create a distinction between hard-hitting criticism and smear tactics. And then number two, the ads and campaign materials attack a candidate couldn't contain photos, recordings, or other representations of the attacked candidate. It's interesting because, again, in our races with the printed ones, it's amazing how they sharp and clear of a picture they can have of the opponent, but you They always say, or you see them on TV as where they're talking slowly, real sinister looking. And now with Photoshop and so on, you can do whatever you think makes a person. You can make their eyes a little deeper set if you think it makes them look more sinister or evil. It just distorted it a little bit so they don't look as nice, so they whatever. So if you're going to use, if you think back again, in any printed materials or whatever, when there was a comparison or an attack on a candidate, did they ever show the candidate in a flattering pose? Of course not. Anyhow, and then finally, last-minute attacks that you, I think the proposal in mind, I think we had come up with, in terms of last-minute attacks, you could not do it, it may not be published in the last 3 weeks before a primary or general election in a legislative race in the last 10 days in a statewide race, except to respond to criticism of the candidate by an opponent or a new position taken by an opponent during that time. And again, this is all voluntary. If I think my opponent is doing something, whatever, and I feel I have to respond, I can do it. But if it's within that period of time and it's not something new, it's just, I just found out my opponent has done this, and I want to run an ad that's going to appear the day before the election. Well, yeah, I have a constitutional right to do it, but it would violate the voluntary code. And then real quickly move beyond this to get open for discussion. The enforcement would be this this Minnesota News Council motto thing. It would be a nonprofit, privately funded by foundations thing. It would be fairly, and unlike the Minnesota News Council, which gets 20 complaints a year and they take up 15 of them or whatever and they interview them in great length, you have to have any ads they see that they think might be, or if I as an opponent say, hey, look, this ad attacking me violates that premise. It doesn't meet the code. Then they could just say, no, yeah, this one violates the code. And if the media, it requires the media, it requires the public to say, we don't want it. And every one of us will say, we don't like negative ads, but every one of us is influenced by it. But if we say, these things violate that standard, and here's why those standards are important, then I think you have a chance that people stop doing it, because they realize if there is that social sanction, they are pressured into doing it. And then finally, because, and this is the part that comes from most other codes, those 3 points were meant to be very subjective, objective. Is the attack made by the candidate, not by a surrogate? Is there a use of photos or voice or whatever of the person you're attacking? And is it done within this period of time with these exceptions? Those are things that could be reviewed by a staff of a council just very quickly. And because there are new ads and there are hundreds of races in a community, you could do it very quickly. And then the more subjective things suggested a candidate, in order to do this, would sign a pledge, which is much more subjective. Candidate would agree to abide by the advertising code, to publicly repudiate and urge voters to ignore a communication that violates this. And I've seen one race near us, a legislative candidate had some attacks on his opponent that he had promised to do a clean campaign. And his party, happens to be my party, ran some, his legislative caucus ran some ads attacking his opponent, saying he deserved an F on his report card. Education was a big issue and in that district, and the opponent was a school board member, and he deserves an F for the education thing. And this guy said, I condemn that. I promise not to do this. I'm angry at it. I urge voters to reject this. My opponent is not a whatever it said. And so he said, my opponent is not this. My opponent also condemned it legitimately so. And anyhow, that guy did lose the race, and whether that smear piece affected it or not. But the point is, the candidate publicly repudiated and went out of the way to do it. And then you would promise not to criticize opponents in a way that's deceptive, misleading, taken out of context. That, again, is very subjective. It's hard to do. Oh, no, I didn't take it out of context. But these are things you would be pledging to do. You pledge not to disseminate campaign communication appeals to hatred or discrimination because of the person's race or religion or ethnic background or whatever. You take communication responsibility for communication your campaign puts up. You wouldn't use push polling and other things like that. Push polling is the kind of tactic where they're not really polling. But they call you, yes, we're taking a survey and want to know if you who you support in this race, okay? And who you're supporting in the race, then you get to the race that you want. And, well, would it change your mind if you knew that candidate X had molested children? I mean, that's an exaggeration, but they've done things. Would it change your mind if you knew they had filed for bankruptcy? Or if they had had run out on their debts or something? Or if they had done this or they've done this? And sometimes, would you change your vote if you knew this? Sometimes the things they say are true. Sometimes they're just made up. If you knew your opponent had failed to pay taxes and then moved out of state when this happened. Well, we didn't accuse them of doing it. We just said, if you knew this about your opponent, would you change it? But they're designed to sound like a poll, and they push you in with the implication you're doing. So you pledge not to do things like that. You pledge to participate in at least two debates if they were offered by a neutral party. Anyhow, that was my premise on how to try and do it. And one of the things I guess I'd like to do here now, and I'm sorry I didn't mean to talk this long, but I'd like to open up and see how this fits in with your models. Would this do any good in the things you've seen? And for that matter, I'm interested in hearing what you're seeing, too.
Okay. I think the word is context. It is the most important thing. My husband was in the legislature, and I was chairman of the school board, and his opponent in one of the races said that he voted against school buses. Well, anybody who's thinking, obviously, after he couldn't come home if he voted against school buses, but it was tacked on to the end of a bill, which most of the smear campaign that we get in our home is out of context. You don't like the main bill, so you're not voting for something that somebody tacked on to the end of it. But the public has no clue.
Right. So. And if you look at, yes, that's exactly, most of the attacks on issues nowadays are somebody voted for something that was part of a bigger bill. It's twisted in a certain way to persuade you that something's not the case. And again, that is saying, oh, that's a lie. Or that's absolute distortion. That's absolutely unfair. Oh, no, it's not. That becomes subjective, which is why the way I hope this code would impact it is if his opponent is willing to say, he voted against this and this and this, and then when you have a chance to rebut it, people say, this guy is slimy, the guy who's attacking you. That's unfair.
But you don't have the chance when it arrives the night
last
before.
Minute, which is why the earlier period, too, because I think you'd be in a hopeless bind trying to say, well, this is out of context because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, it's out of context. That's the whole nature of it. Some of my colleagues who just get elected, and it's amazing how the legislative caucuses, the staff, and leadership, they protect the newcomers. They protect the freshmen. So they don't have to do controversial votes. And they'll often tell them, well, even if you feel this way, in your district, you'd be better off doing this, which really offends me. But they take care of their party members, their freshman members. They want to make sure they don't do this. And I've always told people, if you believe in something, you can. I'm a Democrat who happens to live in a Republican community. And I've won, despite being the only one to vote against controversial things against things that are very controversial positions. The only one in the Senate at times. And still been able to win. I think when you explain, if you believe in something strong, and you can explain why you did it, yes, this is true, but I think people can understand that. So I've told these freshman colleagues, don't be shy about voting for what you believe in if you have an explanation for it. They don't need that issue to attack you. They'll make up an issue if they don't have a legitimate issue. And that's exactly what they do. They make up the issue. And but I do think in that type of example, if it's not the last minute, which would violate the code, and if it's not made by the candidate and his opponent's willing to say things that are clearly out of context and you have a chance to respond, I think it makes the mudslinger look like a mudslinger. And that's the nature of what I'm trying to do. So, anyway.
John?
Yes?
One would assume from the outside that somebody's got to like the system the way it's running. I mean, none of us like negative political campaigns, but obviously it works. So somebody must It would seem to me that some group of politicians or some branch of the way the system works, you mentioned the consultants, knows this works and they like to do it because it works. I mean, and that seems to me to be the real issue.
Yeah. And that's why you got to find a way to make it not work for them in a constitutional way. But with candidates, it's amazing how a lot of new candidates, and like legislative and school board and county board and first-time candidates who aren't professional politicians, the people who are just citizens coming in and getting in the process, you know, they see what somebody wants to do and say, this is what my opponent, they know that's not really fair. And they cringe at it. So more and more often, it's not the candidate putting it out. It's like that example in the race near my, it was two first-time candidates, a school teacher and a school board member running against each other. Strong disagreements on the issue. But both of them ran honorable campaigns. And then my party, which was helping its candidate, ran this smear stuff. I don't know if anyone in here is Northfielders now, but there was a race in Northfield, Minnesota last year where a candidate lost by like 30-some votes. And that candidate's party sent out smear stuff like that. And the candidates in these cases are, oh, it's so outrageous, it's hurting me. They go door to door and people say, why are you saying these smear things about your opponents? And sometimes they're amateurish smears that they're not, smears can backfire because people hate them. And they're not, and they're too obvious of an unfair tactic. But no, it's candidates often themselves hate them, but they're persuaded by the experts. When I ran statewide, you know, why do we have one of these media consultants? Why? Well, I was naive about this. I'd never run a statewide race before. This is, of course, what you do. You got media firms from all over the country. I wanted to do something from Minnesota. I mean, that was my hope. But no, all these folks from California and Washington and Pittsburgh and everywhere else come in, and they have demo tapes. They send you all kinds of stuff. They fly in. They're expense two or three people, and when you see how much you pay them, you see why, you know, they're expending all this money on this. I was amateur at this thing, and we're told you have to do this, and you go, that's one area of no expertise in media buying and media consulting and media this, and biggest single mistake of my political career was thinking, well, I mean, I should adjust to my gut instincts, but instead, you know, you're in over your head on this, and somebody tells you you have to do this, and so candidates are told, I know you're going to hate this, but you got to do it. And you wouldn't believe how many candidates, I think, go home and have sleepless nights over whether they should really be doing this. I think that there are lots of candidates who hate it. Well, what's wrong with it? I mean, there's a whole lot of that, too, but a lot of candidates really...
So it's ingrained into the system somehow.
The system and the political experts who know what they're doing, and I think they're wrong in many cases.
And a follow-up question is, you know, I see these nice, I think a presidential campaign is, I think, the most generic for us, but you see these nice ads with the person who's running who's respectful, et cetera, et cetera, and then they smear things around the corner.
Yeah.
And you go, they have to know that's being run.
Of course they know it's being run. And many times it's independent expenditures, which technically you're not allowed to know. Well, we had one in Minnesota's new governor had ads, and he was fined a big amount by our campaign finance board. His party was running ads using film clips that were filmed of him speaking into an ad, things that they were filming for their own ads, and somehow these ads were being run by the party without their knowledge or consent. It was clearly with their knowledge. I mean, they acknowledged that, oh, well, it was our campaign consultant sold the tape to his buddy, who's a campaign consultant for the party, and they just, oh, yeah, we sold it to him. So they pay the campaign to give him the stuff, and then they're not going to use it? No.
But in the state of Washington, personal experience, the caucuses send out material that the candidate does not know anything
about.
Right.
Well, in the cases, the two cases I mentioned here, that was exactly it, where the smear things.
Yeah.
In those cases, and that's because those candidates are, that's not statewide, it's legislative races where lots of times the candidates are newcomers. And well, after I got elected, I remember my majority leader giving a lecture in one of our caucuses where I was voting a different position on a tax bill from what they thought I should want. And I got a lecture about how you in this district and you should not be voting for this because you don't know. I was going to say, you know, look, I spent a year of my life fighting to get here and now now you're telling me I should vote the way my opponent wanted to vote in order to get reelected? Why have me as a middleman? Just vote for my opponent in the first place. You're right. The caucuses, the lower levels, they do that because the candidates would never approve it. But in this case, I was saying where our governor's party sent out big ad expenditures using him in it. That was warm fuzzy. That was him in it. He knew it was, he didn't know the specifics. They got to keep the candidate in the dark about it. If anyone gets in trouble, can't have the candidate know about it. But some of the smears at the legislative levels, the candidates are totally clueless, and they're really angry. I mean, some of them are, maybe this will help, but a lot of them, they go door to door, and they see what people are saying about it, and they're furious that their party is helping them. Mm-hmm. And in many of those cases, there are actually negative things that backlash against them. You had a point.
Does voter apathy promote this?
Yes. And this promotes voter apathy, which is why you have this.
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah. So what do we need to fuel the engine to get back to where it should be?
And again, I would argue that today's talk on clean campaign advertising and so on is part of it. I do think people asking candidates, where's your position paper? In our local suburb, we have local politics are often more nasty than anywhere else, more personal than anywhere else, maybe because of smaller bodies of people, a city council of 5 members. And anyhow, last race was a hot one, and the mayor kept saying he was the new candidate, was outgoing mayor and 3 new candidates running. The candidate who won ran, every mailing, every brochure he handed out was, he's the candidate willing to talk about the issue. And then there's a couple of family pictures and other things on the cards and flyers. And then click on his website for the details. Well, I'm kind of curious who this guy is. I didn't know him very well. And I clicked on his website, and there's the thing. Oh, here's his background. Here's this on the issues. Coming soon. You know how you develop websites. I checked on this every couple of weeks because I was curious, because he kept telling people to go to the website. And 2 weeks out, there was still nothing under the issue segment. And I think if people demand candidates talk about issues, if they ask, do you have an issue paper on it? Bigger races, candidates either just out there at the Times, so they just figure out right off that vote, or the biggest races, if a statewide candidate running for governor or attorney general or some broader offices doesn't have somebody who's willing to pull together some issue papers and get them, and if you have questions about what they mean or this is all generalities, send them back saying, well, how would you do that? I mean, to a certain point, the voters and the media and everybody else has an obligation, and I'd argue at a certain point you need candidates who are willing to speak out on those, on substance too, because there's nothing. I think one of the reasons I won the first time, despite all the ridicule of these long position papers, was that people could see I gave him something to do, and maybe they don't agree with this guy, but at least he's willing to tell you where he stands, and his opponent was fluff. And I never mentioned my opponent's name. In debates we talk, and all that sort of thing, but that's give and take, and he can rebut anything I say. But I never mentioned him in any brochure until the last 2 weeks out. He sent out a real smear thing, and so I said, here's just the facts or something, and I quoted, and later on I was told, you should never restate the charge, paraphrase the charge, but here's what he said, and then here's the response. And that was all I did. And I won despite being attacked and despite giving substance as opposed to that. I think people do want substance, but they kind of get the expectation because no candidate gives it to them. They're not supposed to have it.
Go to the forums, too. I mean, a candidate goes and you meet the other candidate, and pretty soon you know their wives.
Yeah, we have women voter forums in our legislative races, and they're a good turnout will be 70, 80 people.
Oh, that's gigantic.
They'll often do a House candidate and Senate candidate, the same thing. So you got 4 candidates, and you got their campaign managers and a couple other people, and 10 people from the League of Women Voters. And in the end, you figure you got about 15 or 20 people who aren't whatever. At least they do broadcast them on cable, and while I was ridiculing the size of cable audiences, I mean, saying it's a small percentage, there are people who watch. I mean, I know our legislative hearings and floor sessions are on not cable anymore. In the Twin Cities area, they're on public broadcasting backup channel. And you wouldn't believe how many people, I saw you on TV the other night at 10:30. And there are people who watch those things. And so there are some who pick up debates that way. But if people demand debates, they're debates. If nobody demands them, running statewide, I tried to get my opponent to debate. And he was willing to debate in front of the Chamber of Commerce, which had endorsed him. nobody else.
Have you introduced this proposal to the political community?
This is the first stages of it. I actually introduced it in the form of legislation, Senate File 5. At the very beginning of the year, I dropped it in with some other campaign and other reforms. And the interesting thing is every time I say that, I have to explain, this doesn't need legislation to do. I just wanted legislation as part of the way to introduce it. I plan to do some writing on it, speaking on it, because our session ended a month and a half or so before we came here, but I still was catching up from the end of the session, haven't been able to start doing it. So one of the reasons I like these Holden talks is I hear, hey, wait a minute, this is really off base on that, but I'm planning to push it that way. And I've been in contact with this campaign conduct group in Maine, the Pew Foundation effort, and Paul Simon, the former senator from Illinois, is head of a public policy institute in Southern Illinois, and he's doing a thing on clean campaigns soon and trying to promote it there and so on. So it's just early phases of it. So I welcome feedback, not necessarily just today, but if you think of anything else, I should be, wait a minute, what about this?
I'd sure like to see time limits on the comments you can make. You know, the Bible says twice, in prayers, Lord, forgive me the follies of my youth. And I'm almost of a persuasion that we ought to be making mistakes when we're youngsters. Those who scoot through life without making any errors probably haven't taken any risks and tend to be shallower. But today you can uncover anything about people. And it would be nice to have some time. Before that, you just cannot be dragging up things.
Hey, well, I was going to say that I'm not expert in this, so I hesitate to raise the example, but in California, a congressman who's been funding with, I think, $2 million or so of his own money, funding the recall initiative of the governor. Why? Because he wants to run for it, and they have a strange law where anybody else with 50 names or 200 bucks or something can file and be on the ballot, and it's plurality winner. So if the voters throw out the current governor, then it might be 10% of the vote you win. Anyhow, this congressman's trying to do it, and it was interesting that this guy made his money selling car alarms, car theft prevention systems, and I think a year ago or so it came out that this guy has several convictions as a young person for auto theft. So it's really ironic, and I'm not sure that I would say that shouldn't be discussable in a campaign. I think I'd feel a lot better if the people doing it's public knowledge now, so the public can raise it and everybody else can raise it. I think it's a legitimate issue for discussing there. I think going back and saying, what in somebody's personal life, what in mistakes they made, Martin Luther said not encouraging people to sin, but he said sin boldly, meaning, you're going to do things, you're not going to know, you make mistakes in life, and I think you make a good point. We don't elect saints. It'd be nice if we had the choice, but there aren't a lot of saints out there to elect. And we're electing human beings to very human offices. And my talk tomorrow on campaign finance money, I think we're talking about that issue. I think I would argue that 90-some percent of my colleagues are very honorable people, but that the system is corrupt. And when you're dealing with human beings plugged into a corrupt system, they unintentionally do things that aren't there. And we're not electing saints. We're electing human beings. Point that how you do it. Same thing, could we eliminate is shorten the time for the campaigns? I'm fighting right now a proposal to triple the length of Minnesota's general election season, move our primary from September, the week after Labor Day, to put it in early June. It's both political parties, both major parties have endorsed this and are heavily pushing for it, and the governor's supporting it, and half the legislators are. It keeps coming up every 3 or 4 years, and I've offered, I got a thing already printed up, a phony news story. Minnesotans rally for longer campaigns, and then quoting fictitious people, obviously a phony story that was going to hand this out on the floor when the debate comes up. You know, nobody's asking for longer campaigns. It's political parties, both of them think they've got some strategic advantage by lengthening the general election, but we can't constitutionally shorten it. I mean, it would be nice if Britain, they have very short, intense campaigns, but we can't ban people from talking and promoting themselves earlier times, but we should structure it as a way we can to try and compact it.
I certainly echo the concern about cynicism that the ads promote, and also that it lessens a person's willingness to be involved at any level in the political process. One of the phenomena that we've seen in our own household is both our two sons, ages 22, 25, very astute and aware of the issues, et cetera, et cetera. I think partly what happens is with the general atmosphere of campaigning, their perception is there's really no difference between Republicans and Democrats. They're major political parties. They all function for a lot of subtle self-interest, blah, blah, blah. Consequently, they flat out refuse to vote for anyone that's a Democrat or Republican, and they'll go to the Green Party or Independent, whatever, or
Libertarians.
And it's not saying that they're not good candidates, but what surprises me is that the Democrats and Republicans are willing to let that happen, which is counterproductive for their own selfish interests.
Well, and partly that is everybody's aiming. I mean, this whole concept, well, we're going to create this fictitious middle of the road, the theory, the political theory, which the consultants and everybody buy into, and I don't buy this whole thing. Most people vote for, I mean, Minnesota had elected a guy named Rod Rams, who was considered, I don't like these terms, but conservative Republican, and Paul Wellstone, a liberal Democrat, and Jesse Ventura, who was a kind of off-the-wall everything. All were in office in the three state highest state offices at the same time. Well, Minnesotans, they have one guy way over here, one over here, one way out there. And then, what are voters thinking? Well, voters don't vote strictly by ideology. Everybody at the Capitol does. The reporters, I think, do. The candidates do. The staff do. The lobbyists, they all vote by political ideology, but the average voter votes, is this somebody that trusts their judgment? Is it something else? But this whole theory is, well, to get the Republican nomination, you move to the right, the Democrat, when you move to the left, then you move to center and get as many of the voters as you can. I remember in 1980, I was fairly new out of college, and I remember how many Democrats were thrilled that the Republicans nominated Ronald Reagan. He was such an extremist, and we had the centrist. People don't vote for centrist or left or right. They vote for people they trust their judgment of. And my whole argument to people is vote for what you stand for, not trying to figure out, I don't believe in anything, just I'm going to take a poll and whatever looks popular, and how can I sell that and get my supporters to pull along that way and get the middle of the road people here and get these people here. But that's part of the cause of the cynicism. This negative ads is part of the cynicism. And I think criticism is very healthy. Critical attitude is very healthy. Cynical attitude, yeah, turn off. Criticism implies you like, you want to change things. You want to make things better. Cynicism gets to the point where it's hopeless. Give up on the whole process. And I think that's one of my fears about this. But those of you who are going to be in the village the next few days or so, if you think about some of these ideas and think about how it's impacted on whether that would do anything in your community, not that this happens, but if this were to happen, would that make a difference? Because you don't want to push something if it's not going to do anything. But I appreciate help on that. But we got to quit in just a second. Go ahead.
Just so quick, I think, if this were to happen, then would this be something that voters would be aware of in terms of
the whole point? The whole point would be that you have big efforts to promote it. The media would have to buy in, or the media in Minnesota has these truth moments or political reality checks or whatever, where the media, they analyze ads. Well, is this true or false? And this is true or false? And they go, well, this is sort of misleading because of this, or this is true, or this is false. And they're trying to put objective standards on this, and I was going to say, usually I sort of agree with what they're saying, but sometimes I think, well, they're picking the little facts in the thing and saying those are true, but the whole picture is really misleading. The media tries to do those and they get attention. If the media would buy into something like this, and say, look, you know, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, whether you're over here in the spectrum, over there, over here, you can objectively agree that this is a smear, as opposed to a hard-hitting criticism of somebody you disagree with. And here's how we can sort out the smears from the hard-hitting thing, and it would only work if the public cares about it, which I think they do, and the media buys into it, and you'd obviously need some candidates to not cross the line. If everybody's saying just the heck with it, then it's not going to do any good. But it would have to be quiet. The whole point of this is social sanctions against the candidate, because there wouldn't be any legal ones where they feel forced to change. So, anyhow, I appreciate your attention at this. This is a new attempt to address, I think, a major problem, and I welcome any feedback afterwards as well. Thank you for your attention.